Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Conservatism needs to be rediscovered. That is, it needs to be differentiated from the post-World War II concept of liberal democracy and returned to its traditional three pillars of religion, nationalism, and economic growth. And it needs to be thought of as Anglo-American conservatism, rooted in the tradition of the English Constitution, going back to such thinkers as John Fortescue, circa 1394 to 1479, and John Selden, 1584 to 1654. We need to be a God-fearing nation with nation and religion at the center of our national belief system. We must live conservative lives. These are some of the arguments made by the political theorist and public intellectual Yoram Hazony in his 2022 book, Conservatism, A Rediscovery. It is a provocative book that even many conservatives will take issue with. For example, Hazony puts a good deal of emphasis on the importance of hierarchy, both within the family and in society at large. Given that a good deal of the rationale of right-wing thinking in recent years has been predicated on the necessity for nonviolent rebellion against the establishment in the Republican Party and the left-wing dominance of academia, Hazony's arguments may not be embraced by large swaths of the right. But to get conservatives and those on the right who do not identify as conservatives as thinking about what they stand for, what they want, and how to get it is one of the goals of the book. It succeeds. To those who might blanch at the embrace of religion in the public sphere, Hazony argues that for all intents and purposes, the increasingly powerful political philosophy, woke neo-Marxism, is itself a religion. Hazony criticizes the right for acquiescing in the relegation of traditional religion to the private sphere. He argues robustly for religion, particularly Christianity, to serve as a countervailing force to wokeism. In the face of a progressive order that leaves people in the position of being unable to distinguish between, say, a man and a woman, Hazony advocates for such measures as ending the ban on the Bible and God in the public school classroom. This is a full-throated defense of conservatism and is therefore must-reading for those on all sides of the political spectrum. Hazony addresses the need for the idea of a nation, its cohesion, and its inherited traditions. For that, he says, you need conservatism. And by conservatism, he means a public conservatism, a public traditionalism in those places where there's a majority that will support it. Hazony maintains that our culture must support parents and congregations in the work of the transmission of values that ensure respect for tradition, nation, and hierarchy. This book is a substantive intellectual history of conservative thought and profiles significant figures in the conservative movement, for example, William F. Buckley, Frank Meyer, and Russell Kirk. It is also a clarion call for those who claim to be conservatives to live genuinely conservative lives. Hazony urges conservatives to stand up for principles like the public acknowledgement of God and such core values as the honor due to parents by their adult children, loyalty within marriage, and observance of the Sabbath. In the Hazony version of conservatism, all 10 of the Ten Commandments ought to be the basis for our country's social and political life. He includes in his book, a memoir of his days at Princeton University in the 1980s, where a campus culture of loose living and rampant drinking led him to seek out a life of faith and family. College students of today and their parents would do well to read this moving chronicle of a young person surrounded by decadence who escapes its ravages via a solid marriage and a return to traditional religion. Let's hear from Mr. Hazony about his book and the path forward for conservatives and America itself. Hello, everyone. My name is Hope J. Lehman, and I am one of the hosts of the New Books Network. I am talking today with Yoram Hazony, the author of the 2022 book, Conservatism, A Rediscovery. Thank you for joining us today, Yoram.
Hello, Hope. I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, thank you. I'm very honored, and I very much enjoyed reading your book and learned a lot from it. I'd like to start with the title. What do you mean by the word use of the word rediscovery? For example, what do you feel has been forgotten by conservatives? And who would you point to on the public stage in our own day as being conservative? There seems to be a huge range of figures that some might point to, from people like Ben Shapiro or Tucker Carlson, to politicians such as Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, to Supreme Court justices like Amy Coney Barrett and Clarence Thomas. I do want to make clear that your book is not primarily concerned with the rough and tumble of retail politics, but could you orient us a bit about what conservatism looks like right now?
Sure. I think traditionally there's been a the United States and other Western countries, there's been a familiar debate between liberals and conservatives. And in the traditional way these terms were used, a liberal was somebody who would think that politics is basically about the rights, the individual liberties, and equality of the individual. And conservatives, although they might and do cherish individual rights, conservatives tend to begin with the existence of loyalty groups, of a family, a tribe, a nation, and ask the question, what do I need to do in order for my nation to be able to go forward across the generations, to get stronger from one generation to another? Now, when you think in terms of this kind of conservative way of looking at politics, you have to talk about questions like, is the society cohesive? Does it hold up under external and internal pressure? What do we need to do in order to make people loyal to the inherited traditions of the country and to defend its independence? And I think that this crucial debate between liberals and conservatives largely disappeared from American and European public life after the fall of the Berlin Wall. There's kind of this dramatic collapse of communism, followed by what I see as kind of a utopian embrace of liberalism across the political spectrum. So there could be arguments between Democrats and Republicans, but pretty much everybody became a liberal. And I think a lot of what we're seeing today reaching its climax in 2020 with sort of the takeover of many of the liberal institutions by woke neo-Marxists is the result of the suppression or the disappearance of this genuine conservative way of thinking. And the book proposes that we should rediscover it both historically and at the level of political theory and personal life.
Well, that's very helpful. I wanted to ask about, there's a new movement called National Conservatism, and you're one of the leaders of that. I wonder if you could differentiate that between, say, the thought of William F. Buckley, the fusionism of Frank Meyer, the conservatism of people like Irving Kristol, whom you admire, I know from the book, and Richard John Neuhaus, and the integralism or post-liberalism of people like Patrick Deneen and Adrian Vermeule. And who were the thinkers? Who are the American thinkers that most influenced you on the formation of your own conservatism?
Well, that's a lot of questions.
Yeah, your book is so rich. I think every line in the book is underlined. I went through several pens on it.
Oh, thank you. So I would say that in terms of recent thinkers, meaning the last couple of generations, mm-hmm. I think that Irving Kristol probably, who I knew personally, probably had the largest impact on my political thought. Irving Kristol is remembered as kind of the key figure of the neoconservatives, but we have to be careful with that term because in the 1980s, when I was first getting reading conservatives and getting involved in this kind of political thought, the word meant something very, very different from what it means today. Today, the word neoconservative is associated with the support of let's call it liberal internationalism. The idea that that individual liberties, free markets, open borders are what we need in order to govern the entire world, and that the best thing would be if the entire planet would be brought under this kind of worldwide rule of liberals or liberalism. And Irving Kristol was, you know, almost the exact opposite of that. If you pick up his terrific book from 1983, Reflections on a Neoconservative, you'll see that he was very skeptical about the ability of human rights or the freedom of the market to be able to extend beyond the countries where it was first developed, you know, the English-speaking countries. And he was especially skeptical of the possibility of maintaining anything like the free enterprise system in the absence of strong nationality, national independence, and especially religion, which he thought was the most important component of conservatism. And his idea was that the freedom of the market, where, you know, where we get to, you know, buy and sell whatever we want and at whatever price we can, you know, we can agree to by contract. His argument was that was great for economic growth, but that it was terrible for families and nations, basically any kind of loyalty group, any type of group that human beings are loyal to is not based on contract, and it's based on obligations that are inherited rather than being chosen. So just to pick an obvious example, none of us choose who our parents are. We don't even choose who our children are. You know, our children are born and they turn into, you know, to very different kinds of people, and we owe them things, just like we owe our parents and other relations. We're not able to say, no, you know, I wanted this kind of child, but you're the wrong kind of child, so I don't have any obligations to you. And Kristol's point, which I think is a very good recapitulation of something that appears repeatedly through many centuries of conservative tradition, is that these inherited obligations, which are not chosen, they're actually what allows the society to propagate over centuries. And Kristol thought that if you eliminated these involuntary obligations, then you would quickly lose your country, something which is barely discussed by you know, people who call themselves conservatives today.
And the fact that the word nationalism has come to seem almost a pejorative in many people's eyes, that they equate it with white supremacy or everything evil, whereas nationalism is I lived in Asia for several years, and it's not as though the Japanese or the Chinese are not proud of their nations and have a very strong sense of nationhood. Could you talk about the term nationalism and the way it's used now by the left in particular?
Sure. I use the word nationalism the way that, you know, that I learned it growing up in, you know, in my father's house. My family's Israeli. And as you say, many countries like Israel and India, lots of other countries use the word nationalism to mean a theory of the way the world should be governed, where many nations have their independence and are able to chart their own independent course and not be subservient to some kind of foreign empire. And so when Kristol and others were using the term, what they meant by it was the kind of thing that today is associated with Brexit or the Trump movement. I don't mean, you know, necessarily Donald Trump specifically, but the people rallying around what's now called national conservatism are people who are trying to say, look, we're not interested in trying to establish a universal rule of a single law around the entire globe. We don't want to be subjected to it, and we don't want to subject others to it. And that comes down to, that's a big theory, but it comes down to practical politics on questions like, does a corporation, if it's an American corporation, does it have any kind of responsibility to American workers? Or should the owners just be free to move their corporation to China, regardless of its impact on American national security or on the American economy or the availability of jobs? And a nationalist will say, look, there really is such a thing as a nation. And we owe things to our fellow nationals. And that might include slowing down immigration or national steps to reinforce the national religious or constitutional traditions in the school systems. All of these things arises issues as soon as you say the nation is something real that all of us benefit from, and it needs to be protected like the family.
I was going to ask, in terms of national conservatives, is it a recognized movement? Who are its conservative critics, the critics on the right that do not like it? I know there's a lot of unfortunate internecine warfare on the right, and I think your book is a wonderful go-to book to thrash those things out in a very civil way. Could you talk about the national conservatives, and where does one go to find them? Who are their leaders?
Okay, well, it is a recognized movement. It's discussed quite a bit online, in all sorts of media, both by people who like it and people who don't like it, and people are still wondering. The original gathering of what later became the National Conservative Movement was right after Brexit and Trump's election, President Trump's election in 2016. In December of that year, immediately after the election, there was a gathering in Glen Cove, New York, that included people like Rusty Reno, the editor of First Things magazine, Professor Joshua Mitchell from Georgetown.
Yeah, I've interviewed him. He's a wonderful person. Yeah.
No, he's among the finest people I know. John O'Sullivan, who was the longtime editor of National Review, now the head of the Danube Institute, and others. And this group gathered in order to try to talk about at the level of ideas, separating ourselves to a certain extent from the question of political personalities. You know, political personalities are obviously very important in elections, but when you're trying to figure out, you know, what's the overall public philosophy, what's the framework that we want to go forward with, it's helpful to back off a bit from, you know, day-to-day developments in politics and talk about, you know, what ideas are causing harm? What ideas are potentially beneficial, and what do we need to bring, you know, to advance in order to bring health to a given country or to various countries? So that led to a series of large conferences, which have now been running for several years, called the National Conservatism Conferences. And there've been three annual conferences in the United States. There've been three annual conferences in Europe. And this coming year, it looks like there's going to be NatCon 4 in America and a NatCon UK conference, at least those two. People can find out about it online. There's a website called nationalconservatism.org. When you go to that website, you'll see articles and books by various authors, in addition to the sort of founding members that I named. Probably the most important spokesman for national conservatism in recent years has been Krista Muth, who was the longtime head of the American Enterprise Institute. And what these and our many other colleagues, what we're involved in is trying to restore the idea of the nation to be central in our politics. Now that, you know, that doesn't mean we all agree about everything, but there's definitely a kind of a school of national conservatism, which in the United States is associated, you know, in addition to President Trump, with people like Governor DeSantis and J.D. Vance, who's going to be a senator now. Senator Josh Hawley has been to all of our American conferences. Marco Rubio is also in a lot of ways, I think, an important national conservative figure, and many others. Like, you know, when you look at the website, the last conference had in Miami had about 110 speakers, and these are people. Most of them are not politicians. Most of them are academics, journalists, think tank people who are trying to apply the principles that we're talking about to all sorts of particular issues.
Well, I was going to say, you mentioned the importance of ideas. And one of the strengths of your book is that in some ways, I don't think it's a rediscovery. To me, it was, and I think for other readers, it was really an introduction to conservatism. For example, you mentioned a figure that I had never heard of, and you call him the greatest conservative, John Selden. And I wonder, could you talk about him and the importance of his period and the formative ideas for what you're working on in our time?
Sure. There's kind of like this slogan. It's like an intellectual slogan that you hear all the time, even among very educated people. They say that Edmund Burke was the first conservative or the founder of conservatism, and that, you know, that's it's a strange thing to think, because if you open, you know, Burke obviously was this. This great Anglo-Irish statesman during the time of the French Revolution, who became famous in history as the leading opponent of French revolutionary ideas, and probably the person most responsible for preventing the French Revolution from taking hold in Britain. But when you open Burke's book, what you see is that he's an advocate of Anglo-American traditionalism, or we call it conservatism today, but basically it's a political theory that says that the heart of any constitution, of any political order, is its religious and legal traditions. So when you ask, well, how can he found the school at that time if he's defending the traditions, you immediately see this kind of absurd contradiction that actually Burke is not the founder of anything, and he doesn't think he's the founder of anything. What he's doing is he's defending this tradition that he thinks is 400, 500, 600, 700 years old. One of the characters that I want to wanted to reintroduce together with my historian friend, Dr. Ophira Ivry, who is the expert on Selden, was this figure, John Selden, who was who is named explicitly by Burke as one of his crucial forebears. Selden lived at the time of the first half of the 1600s, when after Queen Elizabeth died and James of Scotland became James I of England. And James was a political theorist and who wrote books on political theory. And his political theory was that the king makes all the decisions and any kind of law comes from the king by right. And Selden, was the greatest common lawyer at the time, meaning he was the greatest jurist in addition to being the most important political theorist of his generation. He was a member of parliament, and he, together with Coke and Eliot and other famous people of his generation, he led the resistance against the king on the grounds that the English have an inherited constitution. And he was the principal author of what was called the Petition of Right. The Petition of Right demanded that the king recognize traditional inherited rights of Englishmen that had been, you know, according to Selden and others, that had been discovered through trial and error over centuries, a tradition with its roots in the Bible, but then that was applied to England over centuries. And they succeeded in getting James I to agree that these were in fact traditional rights. Now, what's interesting about this assertion of rights against the crown is that if we look a little bit forward, we'll see that the rights that Selden is talking about, they're the same rights that then become the basis for the American Bill of Rights a century and a half later. And often people claim that the Americans founded, you know, that their Bill of Rights is based on reason, and they don't like to mention that the American Bill of Rights is actually a codification of English rights that had already been codified 150 years earlier. That's going forward. Now, if we go back just a little bit in history to the late 1400s, we can find a book called In Praise of the Laws of England by John Fortescue, who is the inspiration for Selden. And you open this book, you can buy there's a new Cambridge edition that's really easy to read. It's a short book and the spelling's cleaned up, so you can really easily understand it. And this fellow Fortescue, who was also the Chief Justice of England, now we're in the late 1400s, which is like, it's crazy. You know, we're talking about 600 years ago. You open the book and it's like you're reading about the American Constitution today. There's the separation of powers, the bicameral legislature, the responsibility of Parliament of the legislature for laws and taxation, the executive veto, the jury trial. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's like you're reading something 600 years old, but it's the same ideas that today people say, oh no, they were invented at the time of the American Revolution. Well, they weren't invented at the time of the American Revolution. And to be a conservative, I think is to understand that the freedoms that we cherish are based on a dense and complicated tradition. And if you don't know the tradition, then you don't know how to uphold it, and you quickly lose it.
Yes, I think one of the great strengths of your book is you make the point that the American Constitution is a profoundly conservative document. It harkens back to a restoration of rights that George III was deprived, traditional rights that were being deprived. It wasn't necessarily a progressive document. It was saying, these are long established rights that you are overturning, King George. I think that was a really helpful background to the book. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing with you.
Well, apropos of John Selden, I wanted to squeeze in and mention that on your Twitter feed, which I recommend highly because it's very funny, and it's both substantive and amusing in your back and forth with some of your critics online. But I think recently there was a charming picture of you on your recent trip to Britain with understanding under the statue of John Selden, which in the House of Parliament, I believe. Is that correct? Or
I was surprised to discover Selden's towering statue there, and my friend who was there in London with me took the photograph, maneuvered me. I didn't realize that this is what was happening. Maneuvered me to stand like under Selden's outstretched arm, and then one of my Israeli colleagues said, Selden is blessing Chazoni for his work, bringing him back. It was a nice moment. And
oh, that's nice.
No, I think if we're talking about rediscovery, I think it's important to emphasize that, you know, the great figures of the past, we only know who they are because in every generation there are scholars and others who do the work of trying to rediscover them. I mean, this is something that people are not so aware of, that I did an entire doctorate in political theory at Rutgers University. It was a very good doctorate, but I came out knowing a lot about liberalism and a lot about Marxism, but we never studied Fortescue or Selden or Matthew Hale or Blackstone or like Clarendon, any of these great conservative figures. They had no place in the way that history was taught for us. And it's a responsibility that we have is to make sure that we always go back and see who's been forgotten, because the way we're taught history is not always the best way.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, I definitely recommend your book in that respect, because to me, many of the figures, and I like to think of myself as a fairly well-read person, but I realize I am not, because these names are totally unfamiliar to me. As I said, John Selden, but Matthew Hale, I may have seen his name, but not realized the importance of his life and his thought. Well, speaking of getting back to your recent trip to Britain, where that photograph was taken, what was the reception of your book, and what is the state of conservatism in Britain at this point? I know this summer has just been incredibly turbulent for the Conservative Party. Is there resolve amongst what is the position of, for example, social conservatives in the British Tory Party at this point? I mean, that it seems as though Liz Truss was just all about taxes and Sunak is all about fiscal conservatism, but is there a place for social conservatives there?
Well, that is among the big questions. I mean, the Tory Party. I was very fortunate to be asked to speak in Parliament. And,
oh, really? That's exciting.
Well, you know, I wasn't speaking, from the podium, obviously, in the Parliament chamber, but they had a side room, mm-hmm. and it was nice. I was told to expect at most 3 or 4 MPs for the meeting, and 15 showed up, and it was lovely and in some ways very encouraging. And in addition to speaking to the parliamentarians, my colleague and I had a significant tour of think tanks and interviews, and I mean the schedule was packed and exhausting, and many of the meals turned into 4-hour discussions going deep into theoretical questions and into current politics. And I don't claim to be an expert by any stretch in current British politics, but my understanding is that the Tory Party, the Conservative Party, has in a lot of ways comparable to the American Republican Party, was drawn into this idea of free market liberalism, the European Union as an instrument for erasing borders and eliminating national sovereignty. Margaret Thatcher would never have stood for this kind of thing, but she was shooed aside in 1990. And after she was ushered off the stage, the Tories went into this kind of hyper-liberal period. And it's not that, you know, that the traditionalists ever really, you know, completely disappeared. England is a very, very tradition-oriented country, even, you know, if the English don't quite recognize it. I mean, they still have royalty. They still have a House of Lords. Mm-hmm. They still have the common law. They still have an established church. Now, you can say that, you know, these institutions are decaying and that people don't take them seriously, but at some level they do take them seriously. And so it's strange to, you know, get to know the Tory party and discover that in addition to serious conservatives, there are many liberals, and there are some who are, you know, deep into woke ideas, even in the Tory party. Mm-hmm. And so
Boris Johnson just seemed to be, I don't know why anyone would consider him a conservative at all. He was just this strangely unprincipled clown that by sheer bravado led that party. I thought, what are they doing with him?
In 2019, he put together a platform that was in a lot of ways a national conservative platform. By the way, the English they call it one nation conservatism, which is the term that that Benjamin Disraeli, the famous conservative prime minister from the end of the 19th century, he coined this phrase one nation conservatism, which his point of view was that the new working classes could be a part of a conservative party, that a conservative party had to take responsibility, you know, not just for the wealthy and the elites and the aristocracy, but also for the working classes. Mm. And he proposed, you know, this ideal of a Tory party, which would be an alliance between you know the traditional aristocracy on the one hand and the new working classes. And so Johnson, you know, I mean, I think this happens in politics sometimes that he and his people succeeded in putting together a platform that spoke that idea and succeeded in bringing a tremendous number of working class voters to the Tory party.
And especially in new geographical areas too, where they had been weak in the past, right?
Right. Throughout the former labor strongholds, it was a resounding, you know, almost unprecedented Tory victory. But I think that Johnson and his people were not prepared for that victory. They didn't know how. I don't think that Johnson, you know, was purposely trying to trick people, but he was not prepared to govern on the basis of the platform that he had sold to the public. And so you know, all of that has led to great confusion. You mentioned you know, Liz Truss was prime minister for 5 weeks this summer, and her fall after such a brief period, a historically brief period, I think triggered an astounding drop of the conservatives in the polls. They lost something like 30 points in 3 months. Mm-hmm. and have not recovered. And that series of events, I think, has created what seems clearly to me to be an opening for a solid, serious, systematic national conservatism, which you know the Tories may turn to it out of, you know, recognition that, you know, that they haven't kept their promises and they're going to be defeated badly for it, but maybe they can't do it, and it may turn out that, you know, some other party on the conservative right will take up that, you know, that cause that's you know, possible under a parliamentary system, that a new party will step forward. What's clear, I think, is that there are, you know, hundreds of people, intellectuals and political activists, deeply involved in right of center politics in the UK, who are now talking about the importance of national conservatism as a set of ideas For the UK, we just announced the founding of a of an Edmund Burke Foundation branch. That's my organization that runs the National Conservatism Conferences, and Professor James Orr from Cambridge is going to be, he is the newly appointed national head of NatCon UK, and we're looking forward to a big convention in the spring.
Well, speaking of Edmund Burke, I wanted to just say that one of the most valuable passages in your book, or sections of your book, that I found very useful was a comparison, side-by-side comparison of the American founding father, Gouverneur Morris, with Edmund Burke, and the differences and the similarities between them. And that passage alone was worth the price of the book. I just thought that was wonderful and very, very illuminating. Moving from actually national politics to the social world that you recommend, and I found it very moving in your book that you talk about the effects of the pandemic on American families and the rediscovery of simple conservative values, such as, because people were locked down thanks to government overreach to a certain extent, but people were eating together and that they were looking after the elderly members are trying to, because, and one of the things, speaking of the elderly people, is you make the point in the book, I was surprised by this, that you were very critical of the nuclear family and saying that that's relegated the elders of in our communities to assisted living and or retirement communities, and there's very little interaction. Could you talk about what you think that the pandemic has done for conservatives, if anything, or has it just made people fearful and dependent on the state and not being self-reliant?
Well, look, I know that an awful lot of people suffered in many different ways from the pandemic and the lockdowns and confused government policies. This is true, not just in America, but in many countries. So I don't want to make it like idyll or utopia or something. But on the other hand, America, like other Western countries, has, I think, been suffering. People talk about the effects of the breakdown of the family, but I think that it's often very unclear what the traditional family was actually like. I mean, there's this kind of image of the 1950s nuclear family, where there's a father who goes to work, there's a mother who stays at home, and they have two or three children in a detached suburban home, and the children go to school, and the mother's left at home in the house. And this nuclear family image, it's often conservatives talk about it as though there's something, as though it's a traditional family. Mm. And it's actually very far from being a traditional family, because, up until the Industrial Revolution, up until 150 years ago, 120 years ago, the average family was a business. The family itself was the central economic unit. It wasn't, that the father went out to work and the children went out to school. Maybe they went to school a little bit, but the children, as soon as they got old enough, they took part in a multi-generational family. It was not just the parents, but there were often grandparents and sometimes even great grandparents. There were often brothers and sisters of their parents within the community, so that cousins were an integral part of it. And a lot of the not only was the business run by the mother and father with the help of the older people and the younger people together, but a lot of education and religion was passed down. And when it wasn't passed down in the family was part of a broader congregation, like a community of families who were kind of an extended family as well. And when you get to 1962, and Betty Friedan, like the famous feminist writer, when she writes about the nuclear family being a tomb, like a a crypt for women, women being, you know, buried alive there. I mean, it's a shocking, horrible image. But there is some truth to what she was saying, because you know, women, I don't think ever in history was there this kind of sharp division of labor where the woman was left alone at home for most of the hours of the day and was supposed to be making a home without the bonds of family and community, without the husband in the house, without the children in the house. And, you know, the fact that so many women, you know, just grew desperate and decided they would also go out and get jobs, and nobody seems to notice that turning of the nuclear home into a shell. It's an empty shell, basically, where the mother, the father, and the children leave it for most of the waking hours of the day. The grandparents aren't there at all because they've all been, you know, sent to a nursing home or something. And that empty shell is just, it's not a home. Now, all you need to do is, like, you know, look at the, you know, for people who are willing to do a little experiment in Bible literacy, the last chapter of the book of Proverbs is a poem to the woman of the house that, you know, we traditional Jews, we sing it every Friday night. And when you read that chapter, you'll see that you, not only do you see that the home is a business, but the woman of the house is in charge of that business. I mean, she's like, you know, doing negotiations with merchants and selling items and producing things. She's like running a factory. And the idea that we conservatives should say, you know, no, a woman's place is an empty home. She shouldn't be involved in the business. I think it's just completely it's completely twisted and unfair. And so, I'm sorry, I've been going on for a while, but it's something I'm passionate about. That you asked about COVID. So, COVID by, you know, this draconian step of, like, you know, kind of causing people to be in their homes all the time. I know many, many people, young people who traveled hundreds or even thousands of miles to rejoin their families because their colleges were closed. And there were families where the same thing happened with grandparents who moved in. People rearranged their lives so that in the limited space and under these terrible external pressures, people started having family dinners again, suddenly discovered the incredible bonds and ties that you can only have with your family, that you don't have with your college friends. You only think you do.
Or your work situation, your work, we're your family. Right. No, you're not.
Right. No, I'm sorry. Your work might be a great place, but when your work gets tired of you, they fire you.
Yeah.
And your family doesn't fire you. A family, you know, the family is the people who you have these unchosen obligations to. And I think a lot of people caught a glimpse during the COVID years of, you know, of some of what has been lost and what might be gained.
Well, at this point, I just want to remind listeners that we are talking today with Yoram Hazony about his book, Conservatism, A Rediscovery. And as I was reading your section about families and the argument for extended families and families where multi-generational households, I was thinking that perhaps the future of conservatism lies with people who are or recent immigrants, for example, from South Asia and Southeast Asia, and Hispanics, because they often have multi-generational families and very traditional views of I don't want to stereotype them, but is there a future for that, or do they become assimilated into the secular liberalism as through within one or two generations?
Well, I think both of those things are true. I think that foreign immigrants are often much more conservative than Americans or Brits or Europeans, meaning than the society that they're moving into. They're coming primarily because they want better employment, but they hope to be able to maintain very often their traditional family structures. In my experience, for most communities, it doesn't last and it gets broken down. The children and certainly the grandchildren are resentful. Why can't I lead, you know, a liberal life, you know, just like my friends, where I'm free from all of these inherited obligations? But on the other hand, if anything at all is going to change, then it is in a more conservative direction. It's certainly going to involve some kind of broad coalition of people who still value a conservative life with others who are more liberal, but at least, you know, they look and see the cultural revolution that the woke neo-Marxism is bringing. And I think a lot of liberals are becoming aware that there's a choice that has to be made here. You can't pretend it's not there. If you don't want woke neo-Marxism to be the dominant public religion or public philosophy of the United States, or at least the part of the country where you live, then there's going to have to be a political coalition in support of traditional values, which are basically biblical values. In America, they're fundamentally Christian values and Christian traditions. And I'm Jewish. I'm an Orthodox Jew, and I think that that Orthodox Jews, like a lot of other non-Christians who are concerned about the what's coming, I think a lot of us would rather make some kind of build some kind of coalition with our Christian neighbors in order to try to save some of the traditions and revive them.
Well, there's a very effective and very funny, but also very telling and sobering passage in your book. It's all three, funny, thought-provoking, and scold a righteous scolding of young, or not even young, just conservative men. And you make the point that many conservative, so-called conservative men, although they might be libertarian, but you say they're basically living a liberal lifestyle. They call themselves conservative, but you make the point that many of them have this rather sad, lonely life where they have liberal friends or liberal values, and they're single, they don't have families, and all they have is a stack of conservative magazines to read. And I thought that was a funny image. And I wonder if you could talk about the fact that the rebuilding the marriage culture. For example, I was in the very moving section of your book about your time at Princeton, the fact that you married very young and that you found your wife who also wanted that life. And that must be very hard for young people these days. And also another aspect of your book that was somewhat related to this is that you make the point that you had to seek out solidity, social solidity and foundational life, because at Princeton at that time, there was a very louche, decadent, highly promiscuous lifestyle that you were surrounded by, and you and your future wife just rebelled against that, and you found a home. And I wonder, would you send your own children to Princeton today, or is it, or what would you recommend to a young person trying to find the happiness you found?
Look, I'll tell you a secret that my oldest daughter went to Princeton. And we have 9 children, and so far it seems like none of the others are going to go through what she went through. I mean, none of them want to, but my oldest daughter, because she went to Princeton, so I got to see the scene a generation later through her eyes, and all sorts of things have changed, but the fundamental thing that I was describing there has not changed, and that is that the whole concept of an 18-year-old going away to college, to, you know, basically leaving the parents, leaving the family, and going to a place where all the other people are also between 18 and 21 or 22. They've also all left their parents. They've left, you know, their hometowns and whatever roots they've had. Mm. And they're in a place where, you know, we think about the university as, you know, as an educational institution. In some ways it is, but in a lot of ways it's not, because mostly you don't have any contact with professors, with adults. You go see the professors, you hear them in classes, but that's a very small part of the schedule. The overwhelming majority of the week of university students is spent with other university students, and they don't, you know, nobody is, you know, regardless of whether they're liberal or conservative or Marxist in their, you know, in their opinions, I think none of them realize that what's happened is that they've all been cut off from their roots. Even if they had good roots in their family, they're all cut off. And, you know, and hundreds or thousands of young people living in dorms with other young people, you've basically decided for them that there are going to be no role models. Mm. That they're not going to be around families. They're not going to see how husbands and wives, you know, at this crucial stage where they're really first beginning to be capable of noticing, you know, really what things are happening around them. And look, if you don't grow up around older couples who have succeeded in keeping their marriage together for 40, 50, 60 years, if you don't live with them, your chances of being able to reproduce it without ever having seen it are extremely small. And the same thing is with raising children. You know, people don't know how to raise children. They're scared of raising children. They're scared of having children. Mm. And, you know, so your question about, you know, this liberal life, which is it's the life of people, even if they vote for conservative parties, it doesn't make any difference most of the time because they've been deprived of an environment where they could see how marriages work, how congregations work, how extended families work, that they don't almost ever get to see the care for the elderly, and they don't know what contribution grandparents make to a family. Like they go to classes where they read Locke or Rousseau, and Locke and Rousseau and these Enlightenment rationalist thinkers talk about family as though it ends at the age of 18 or 20. And most people think that now, that you know, you just go away and you you decide to do whatever you want to do. Well, that sounds great, but the reality is that without any inheritance, without any guardrails, without any models of role models, most people end up, or a lot of people end up, terribly unhappy. They don't know what they want to do, and that makes them prey to, you know, to well, everybody knows this, to killing the time with video games or television or drugs or porn or alcohol. It's all trying to suppress the pain of not having good models for how an inherited tradition can give you good directions.
Yeah, you have a very fascinating section in your book about, you point out with the Enlightenment thinkers and you rattle them off, the people, those thinkers that never had children. Locke never had children, neither did Descartes, Hobbes, Spinoza, or Kant. And then Rousseau had children, but he gave them all away because they were a nuisance to himself. He got rid of them. So that was very, very telling.
Right.
I'm sorry,
Descartes. No, I just I need to correct this, that because it's a mistake that I've made. Descartes actually had a daughter outside of marriage. So like he had a daughter. She died at the age of five. And you know, that's like Rousseau. It's like, you know, every one of these, the people who are absolutely at the center of Enlightenment rationalist political and social thought, you know, who wrote all these books about how to raise children. And it's preposterous that when you read them as a person, you know, who actually lives in a community where people are raising children, I mean, you just feel like you're reading people who are completely ignorant of the subject they're writing about.
I was going to say too, when you talk in the book about the need to create those communities, and you talk about And people have to create those communities, have to seek out other conservatives. And you and also you make the point that it's never too late, that you can be an older person and still create that community. I wonder, could you comment on the national sorting that's happening geographically? Because I know that there are many young, by word of mouth, I've just heard that there are many young family age, young parents that are leaving Oregon, which is this increasingly death culture, sad atheistic state, and moving lock, stock, and barrel with their young children to Florida to create those communities. Are you finding, you yourself have done that to a certain extent with your move to, I mean, you live a very transatlantic or transnational life with your life in Israel versus America. Could you talk about your own life, and did your wife have trouble adjusting to the Israeli life, because she's not Jewish herself originally?
First of all, if my wife Julie, if she had not been a driving force in all of this, then none of it would have happened. Mm. I mean, I'm writing a book with my name on it, but the truth is that all of these ideas that we're talking about are, you know, about family and child raising and honoring parents and being part of a congregation. All of these are ideas that she and I together were pretty much ignorant about almost all of this, you know, when we met our freshman year in college. And you know, we spent decades finding those role models, trying out different communities in constant conversation between, you know, the two of us and some of our other friends, but especially between the two of us. You know, we would go for a Sabbath meal at a new family, and then we'd go home and we'd sit and process everything that we saw, you know, all evening long. Did you see that, you know, that the father did this, that the mother did that? Did you see that the grandparents did this, mm-hmm. and the what happened when the children misbehaved? I mean, this went on for many years, and this the book is. You know, I wrote it, but the ideas are Julie's and my ideas. And there are plenty of sections of the book where even after I wrote it, she said, no, you can't say this because, you know, we actually think, you know, something else. And then she would mm-hmm. explain to me what we think. And then we talk it through. And no, this happened repeatedly. To make a long story short, the story was that that she had a glimpse of traditional Christian family life from her grandparents' home, because there were parts of her childhood that where she lived with her grandparents, mm-hmm. and I had a glimpse of it from my Orthodox Jewish life from my aunt and uncle. Who had six children and were living in an Orthodox community in Israel. And when we decided to move to Israel, we now live in Jerusalem. We live in, you know, in a neighborhood. It's not Orthodox. It's not all Orthodox, but, you know, there's about 15 little synagogues in our neighborhood. So it's a, there are many flavors of religious Jews and less religious Jews, but it's a very, very traditional community, and we are still learning. I mean, we have a new Orthodox congregation that we joined 2 years ago, right after COVID, and there are many, many things about this new congregation and the way that it folds the children of the community into. Like a kind of a learning experience all week long. We're still learning, and we're going to learn, you know, God willing, until the very end. And I think that to your question about people moving to Florida, look, I think it's really, really healthy for people to who realize that they're living in decay and collapse, to move to a place that can be healthier. Mm. But I think it would be a mistake to think that it's sufficient to move to a healthier state, because if you yourself personally do not have in the local congregation or community. If you don't have older models, like, you know, models of examples of married people who've been able to stay married, then you're not going to know how to do it. And you can read 100 books about, you know, how to make your relationship work or how to raise children. These things are, look, they're better than nothing, but they're close to worthless, because people learn things from people. They learn things from older people. They don't learn things from books. And, you know, even if the things that are in the books are true, until you actually experience it, see it over and over again with your own eyes, you don't understand it. You just don't get it. And, you know, it's like reading a book about a tiger or an elephant and then seeing a real one. Like, it doesn't matter what it says in the book. You don't get it. And so what I'm hoping, you know, with this book is in part to touch, and probably more important than anything else, is to talk about the conservative life, which is a life in which you recognize that your own independent thinking about things is not good enough. It can't be good enough. You have to find older people who themselves are have inherited the tradition and are in the business of passing it down. And that's the way human beings work. That's the way we're happy, is when young people are around older people that they can learn from, and when older people are around younger people who they can pass their knowledge to. If you're not in that life of conservation and transmission, it's very hard to be happy.
I was going to say that in your book, we're getting towards the end, and there's so much I wanted to ask you, but I promised I wouldn't keep you too long. But I wanted to say that in the book, you talk about the transmission of values, and you use terms that young people never even hear anymore, such as God-fearing and the words honor and constraint. And I think I just recommend that young people who don't understand conservatism should read the book, because at least they'll understand what it is and what they can take from it, even if they're liberals. Well, I've taken up a lot of your time. I'd like to ask you now the traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Oh gosh, I am working.
You're a busy man. I know it was hard to arrange an interview with you. So,
oh, but you mean what book am I working on?
Or anything, any project at all, whatever you have in your busy intellectual and organizational life.
Well, I describe the fact that, like, we're right now in the, you know, in the process of setting up NatCon UK, and there's a big upsurge of interest also in Italy, where Giorgia Meloni, who was a speaker at our conferences before the whole world knew about her, has just become prime minister. So I'm definitely working on those things, but I have a book manuscript that I've been working on. I'm embarrassed to say this, but it's literally true. I've been working on it for 20 years. It's a book on human nature and how the mind works. And I don't know if people are going to be interested in what I have to say on the subject, but it is the basis for serious conversations about politics or family or religion or just about anything, is to understand, you know, what human beings are like and how we think. So I'm working on that. I'm hoping someone will be interested in publishing it.
Well, I hope I would. Well, we'll be very interested in talking about it in the New Books Network, because we're all about books. So I very much enjoyed talking to you today. And I just want to thank the author we've been talking to today, Yoram Hazony, author of the book Conservatism, A Rediscovery. And thank you, Yoram. And thank you, listeners. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.